This episode was researched and written with the utmost respect for the Inuit culture and storytelling traditions. These stories are not ours to sensationalize. They are shared here to be listened to, learned from, and honored. With that being said, let's dive into the never-empty silence of the Arctic. Beneath the wind, beneath the snow, beneath the ice itself, there are stories. For thousands of years, the Inuit have lived in one of the most demanding environments on Earth. Survival here has never been guaranteed. Knowledge, passed orally, generation to generation, has always been as essential as food or shelter. Tonight, if you haven't guessed, we're traveling north. We're exploring a being said to live where the land ends and the water begins. A figure whispered about when children wander too close to the sea and ice. They are called the Kalupalik. According to Inuit tradition, they're still there, beneath the ice. So pull up a seat and get comfortable, and welcome into the Ominous Archives. I'm your host, Nick.
And I'm Em.
So, Em, you ready for the big snowstorm?
Huh. Ready as I'll ever be.
Yeah, finally. Did you see the weird thing before we dive into the episode of that? You know, they say history repeats and everything. And it has been like every 30 years on the 6th, there's been a major snowstorm for this area.
Oh, slay.
It's insane. It's crazy how it matches up. I just found that. I seen that. Where did I see it? I don't know. Probably social media.
Yeah.
Somewhere that somebody posted about it. I was like, this is interesting.
Well, that's
They
nice.
Say history repeats, and that, like, really does.
Yeah, it's wild.
It is definitely beyond, I'd say, my understanding. But to understand the Kalupalik, we're first going to need to understand the worldview from which they've emerged. They come from the Inuit, indigenous people who have lived in the Arctic for thousands of years, across what now? Northern Canada, Greenland, Alaska, and parts of Siberia. Long before modern borders, long before maps, Inuit communities lived along coastlines and sea ice, following the rhythms of animals, tides, and seasons beyond their control. Which is wild.
Yeah.
To live that, like, to live in that, like, harsh climate is just, like, blows my mind. Like, the fact that the other thing, did you see the, in Russia, the photos of some of the buildings that are, like, under snow?
Oh, my God.
Like, full apartment buildings,
I think.
And it's just wild.
Yeah.
It's, like, almost to the roof. People are jumping out, like, I don't know. I guess you could be dramatic and, like, 16th floor and just into the snow.
Right.
That's it's just wild. Insane. Anyway, the archaeological evidence indicates that the Inuit ancestors have lived in these regions for over 4,000 years. That matters because no story survives that long unless it does something important. The Arctic is not a landscape that allows mistakes. Temperatures can kill in minutes. The sea can take a life without warning. Ice that looks solid can break beneath a single step. For the Inuit, survival has never been about conquering nature, but about reading it and knowing when it is safe and when it is not. That knowledge was not written down. It was spoken. Inuit culture is built on oral tradition. History, law, environmental knowledge, and spiritual understanding are conveyed through stories told at night, during storms, and during long winters. When the darkness stretches for months, these stories are not myths in the casual sense. They are records, instructions, and warnings. In Inuit folklore, the world is populated with beings that live just beyond human sight. They are spirits tied to animals, to weather, to specific places, and while some protect, most punish. What they share is a purpose. They explain why certain rules exist and what happens when they're ignored. The ocean, in particular, is treated with caution. For coastal Inuit communities, the sea is a source of food, travel, and life, but it is also where the most sudden deaths occur. Children fall through the ice, hunters vanish beneath shifting falls, bodies are not always recovered because the water keeps what it takes. This is where the Kalupalik belongs. They are not wandering creatures. They are not found inland. They live at the edges, beneath the shore ice, near tidal cracks, in places Inuit children are warned never to approach alone. They exist in the exact location where danger hides in plain sight. In this way, the Kalupalik are part of a much larger system of Inuit folklore, and one that does not separate the spiritual from the practical. The beings of these stories are not there to frighten for entertainment's sake. They are there to make danger memorable. Because in the Arctic, forgetting a rule can mean disappearing without a sound. And when a child goes missing near the ice, it is easier and sometimes kinder to say something took them than explain how quickly the sea can open.
So when we talk about the origins of the Kalupalik, we have to begin with an uncomfortable truth. There is no first written mention, no creation myth with a clear beginning, no single moment when the Kalupalik enters the world. And that absence matters because the Kalupalik comes from an oral culture, where stories were carried in voices, not ink. Long before outsiders arrived in the Arctic, these stories were already established, already familiar enough that they didn't need an explanation. That tells us something important. By the time the Kalupalik were written down, they weren't new. The earliest recorded references appear in the late 1800s and early 1900s, collected by missionaries, explorers, and ethnographers, documenting Inuit life in coastal regions of what is now North Canada and Greenland. In these records, the Kalupalik are not introduced as legends, but are mentioned casually as beings everyone already knows about. No one asks where they came from, only where they live. And where they live is remarkably consistent. Across regions, the Kalupalik are tied to specific dangerous locations, the edges of shore ice, places where the sea moves beneath frozen surfaces, where tides create hidden cracks and openings. These are not random settings. They are among the most lethal environments in the Arctic, especially for children. I feel like especially for anybody, but yeah, I could say especially for children.
And I kind of think, so I'm not going to, I don't think anything in the, like, Inuit, who else have we covered? We've covered a bunch. Why am I drawing a blank on them all? Mainly all the ones that I've always struggled to say.
Yeah.
But, like, I wouldn't even say, like, they don't really fall in the cryptids.
Yeah.
You know, it's not really a cryptid, because this is, like, this is a part of their,
their folklore. Like,
yeah, their folklore, right? And their thing, and it kind of goes along the way. I think we talked about, like, the Goatman's Bridge, and we kind of said how it was kind of, it may, you know, you kind of look at it as like a tale for people not to go up there and stuff like that, and
right.
You know, it makes it, it in our you know, for us, you can say people would take it and kind of, I don't want to say exploit because that's not the right word, people would push their limits, like with the Goatman's Bridge and stuff like that, whereas this, they, you know, they're using this as like a learning tool and everything like that. But from what our understanding is, you know, I don't think we'll ever, I don't think you'll fully know, because there, a lot of their stuff
we'll fully ever understand.
Yeah. And I think being tied to nature, how the Inuit are and everything, is so different than, like, how we are.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of goes back to when, you know, I swear, the ghost we saw in Gettysburg that Frankie and I saw. There was a, like, going into that day, driving there, I just felt like my energy aligned with Gettysburg. And I feel like that's how they live with nature. They live aligned with nature. So they definitely
really, like, see they don't have
and
to...
know and can do things
yeah.
that we definitely couldn't because we're not aligned the same way.
Really, like, they don't have to try
mm-hmm.
is, like, kind of, like, what I imagine. Like, they don't have to, like, put themselves in that mindset. They just are.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. No, I fully agree. The lore does not place the Kalupalik inland. They do not roam villages. They do not appear in the open tundra. They exist only at the boundary between solid ground and open water. That boundary is unstable. It shifts daily. A place that is safe in the morning may be deadly by afternoon. Inuit adults learn to read these changes over the years, but children cannot. And so the danger needed a presence and something to be remembered, feared, and avoided. In many tellings, the Kalupalik takes children who stray too close to the water. Sometimes the child is never seen again. Sometimes they're said to be kept beneath the ice. These details change from region to region, but the warning does not. What's important is that the story doesn't explain how the child disappears. It explains why. The Kalupalik is not a replacement for the danger. They are its voice. This is likely why the lore lacks a clear origin story. It didn't really need one. The Kalupalik were never meant to be traced back to the beginning. They exist wherever ice meets ocean, wherever curiosity meets risk. As long as children lived near dangerous waters, something needed to be waiting beneath it.
And that something probably does not look great.
No.
The descriptions of the Kalupalik, they vary from one community to another. And that variation is kind of expected anybody would with an oral tradition.
Yeah.
How it's going to span vast distances and, like, multiple generations. But across those accounts, there's certain details that appear again and again. Details that suggest a shared image, even if the edges are kind of a blur.
Yeah, I feel like you get the same kind mm-hmm. of idea.
Yeah, no matter what Inuit tribe or you would talk to, if you were talking to them about this, you'd get it.
Yeah, I feel you like would know. The same
There's not, you know, maybe I would think maybe like eye color difference or something like that, but you're going to the general overall is the same. The Kalupalik is most often described as humanoid, but only barely. Its skin is said to be green or greenish blue, slick and slimy. Sometimes rough like scales, sometimes described as wet, even when it's not in the water. Witnesses often emphasize this smell first. It's a strong, sulfurous odor that lingers, making it impossible to mistake for a human presence. The hair is long, dark, black, sometimes curly, sometimes straight, but consistently described as thick, heavy, and flowing. In some traditions, the Kalupalik is said to use captured children and suck their youthful essence to care for this hair.
Hmm.
It also helps them maintain their own youthful appearance beneath the ice.
Which I, like, find very interesting. They care about that's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
The hands are unmistakably wrong. They are webbed like those of an aquatic animal with long fingernails or claws that extend far past what a human hand should allow. Along a creature's back and limbs, some accounts describe spines, fins, or ridges. Features that give it a resemblance to something halfway between a person and a deep water creature. More than one description likens it to a terrifying mermaid. though far removed from anything graceful or romantic. Closing is another detail that appears with unsettling consistency. The Kalupalik is often said to wear an amatik, a traditional Inuit parka, most commonly worn by women, designed to carry children in a pouch across the back. In these stories, the garment is not protective, it is functional. Some traditions claim it is made from eider duck feathers. Others focus less on the material and more on its purpose. This detail is one reason the Kalupalik is most often described as feminine. While some accounts use masculine pronouns, the creature is overwhelmingly characterized as female, or at least adopting a female form. The reasons are never stated outright, but the symbolism is difficult to ignore. The clothing, the fixation on children, the long hair, the imitation of something nurturing twisted into something predatory.
Yeah, I almost fully agree. Like, I feel like you described this to me and it just does give, like, female, I don't know, energy? Kind of. Yeah. It might be the little comment about the hair that's doing it for me, because as soon as, like, we came to that, I was like, well, wait a minute, that's very, it's like almost like kind of vain, like a little bit. I don't know.
And then there's its ability to change through a technique known as, oh boy, work with me on this one, hold on, I gotta get the pronunciation because this is not gonna end well. Through a technique known as pilutectomanic, the Kalupalik is said to be able to alter its appearance. That was a very hard sentence.
The way you literally forgot to pronounce Kalupalik because you were so worried about that one.
I didn't even know if I got that right.
Well, close enough.
But, you know.
We're trying.
We're giving it a shot. This is very hard. Especially trying to say Kalupalik so many times. Yeah. This is not described in detail, but the implication is clear. What you see may not be what truly is. The creature can appear closer to a human, closer to a familiar, and long enough to draw attention. Just long enough to make someone hesitate.
So because Inuit knowledge is passed orally, the Kalupalik is not a single fixed creature. There is no authoritative version. No final description. What exists instead is a network of related stories that are shaped by geography, danger, and the needs of individual communities. In some regions, the Kalupalik is described as solitary. In others, it is spoken of almost as if it were part of a hidden population. Specifically, beings tied to specific stretches of shoreline return to the same dangerous places year after year. Some accounts describe it not as a physical creature at all, but as a spirit bound to certain coastal waters, unable or unwilling to stray far from thin ice and tidal cracks. What remains consistent is behavior. Across traditions, the Kalupalik is not a random predator. It hunts with intention. One of its most frequently described abilities is sound. Some accounts say the Kalupalik emits an eerie hum from one of its flippers, low, rhythmic, almost soothing. Others describe it as a shrill, piercing sound capable of paralyzing its victims. In certain tellings, the sound mimics something familiar, the cry of a baby or the call of a mother. The goal is not force, but hesitation to cause a moment of confusion at the water's edge. I've said it once before, I'll say it again. Anything that can mimic really just freaks me out. Like, I don't know what it is about, like, the being able to mimic somebody or something. It's just, it's crazy.
It is weird because you always at that point have to second guess.
Right, because you're like, what? How?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I say what to everything.
Yeah.
I did ask a question, my first response is, huh?
Yeah.
And then I'll answer.
I heard the question, Accounts differ on what happens next. In some stories, abducted children are killed and consumed. and others, they are taken beneath the ice and held in a suspended state, neither alive nor dead, where their vitality is said to sustain the Kalupalig's youthfulness. And in other versions, the creature raises the children as its own. This variation is not accidental. Many traditions emphasize that the Kalupalig has no children of its own. Some stories say it cannot. Others say it has lost them. Either way, kidnapping is framed not only as predation, but as substitution, an imitation of family that mirrors human life but distorts it. This is one reason the Kalupalig is so often described as feminine, and why it wears an amulet. The clothing is familiar. The role is familiar. The danger lies in how closely it resembles care. The Kalupalig also possesses abilities that make it difficult to confront directly. In its natural form, it is often described as nearly impervious and resistant to weapons or physical harm. But the Inuit oral tradition does not portray it as unbeatable. Some stories describe hunters outsmarting the Kalupalig through conversation by engaging it, distracting it, and coaxing it into transforming through a technique known as pilutitominic. This is an Inuit term for a specific shape-shifting or transformative ability used by mythical creatures like the Kalupalig, allowing them to alter their appearance, often to lure or caption children near the water's edge in Arctic folklore. Once transformed, often into seals, whales, or other marine animals, the creature becomes vulnerable. In these stories, defeating the Kalupalig is not just survival, it becomes sustenance. The hunter returns home with food, turning a supernatural threat back into something that the community can live on. This detail is important. It reinforces a pattern common in Inuit folklore. Supernatural danger is not eliminated. It is managed, outsmarted, folded back into the natural order. Some modern historians have compared the Kalupalig to the boogeyman, a cautionary figure used to frighten children into safer behavior. But this comparison only goes so far. The boogeyman lives under beds. The Kalupalig lives in specific, lethal places. Its rules are environmental. Its punishments are tied directly to real risk.
And when we talk about modern encounters with the Kalupalig, it's important to be clear about what that means. These are not sightings in the way modern cryptid stories are told. There are no grainy photographs or dramatic confrontations. Instead, what persists are experiences, stories still remembered, retold, and taught within Inuit communities. Not as distant folklore, but as events that happened to people whose names were once known. One such story, recorded among Inuit communities of Baffin Island, centers on a grandmother and her grandson. During a time of extreme scarcity, the elderly woman finds herself unable to feed the child in her care. Faced with the slow certainty of starvation, she makes a desperate decision. In some versions, she calls upon the Kalupalig, asking the creature to take the boy away, believing he might somehow fare better than he would with her. The creature answers, the child is taken beneath the ice, carried away in the hood of the being's parka, and tethered underwater with a length of seaweed so he cannot escape. Time passes. Conditions change. The community's luck improves. The hunting becomes successful again. Realizing what she has done, the grandmother alerts the others, and attempts are made to retrieve the boy. But the rescue is not simple. In some tellings, the child, now influenced by the Kalupalig, will sing warnings when rescuers approach, allowing the creature to pull him back beneath the waves. In others, the hunters are repeatedly thwarted by the being's strength and awareness. Only after careful planning does a man and his wife succeed, approaching silently in deerskin-soled boots and cutting the seaweed tethered at dawn. The boy is recovered unharmed and in many versions of the story, he grows up to become a great hunter. What matters here is not whether the story is interpreted literally. What matters is what it teaches. The Kalupalik is not simply a monster, but a part of a moral and environmental framework. The story speaks of desperation, regret, communal responsibility, and the belief that even supernatural threats can be overcome through patience and ingenuity. Similar stories were documented in the late 19th century by anthropologists working directly with Inuit storytellers, including Franz Boas, whose 1888 fieldwork among the Baffin Island Inuit Preserve accounts of sea beings such as Kalupalin creatures that closely align with later descriptions of the Kalupalik. Boas did not record them as curiosities. He recorded them as living stories, still told and still meaningful. And they remain meaningful today. In a modern era, the Kalupalik has also entered new forms of storytelling. Illustrated children's books, most notably The Orphan and the Kalupalik, have become a primary source of imagery for younger generations. These stories are still used to teach us the same lesson they always have. Stay away from thin ice. Do not go where the water breaks. Listen when elders warn you. Some elders still speak of hearing sounds beneath the ice, of seeing shapes move under frozen water, of an unsettling sensation being watched near dangerous shorelines. These experiences are not always framed as encounters with a literal being, but they are not dismissed either. Which, when you think of that, like, hum that you're talking about and everything, I can only imagine, like, so my thought is, I wonder if the ice, when it has, have you ever walked on, I guess you haven't, you probably shouldn't. Can you say, have you ever walked on, like, thin ice?
No, Nick, I can't say I have.
when we were kids, there's a creek.
Yeah.
And when it would freeze over, we would walk on it, and we're talking, this is a very shallow creek.
Mm-hmm.
So we had some kind of brains when we were doing it.
Yeah, sure.
But you would hear it, like, as you were walking closer to, like, thin ice, mm-hmm. you would hear, like, I don't want to say hum, but, like, it was, like, it was definitely, like, a noise where you could mistake it, or, not mistake, but you could say it was a hum.
Right.
You know, it could be that, or even, I'm wondering if, like, the way the water's rushing mm-hmm. underneath the ice could create, like, that low hum, and that's kind of, like, you know, to tell the kids, like, oh, the Kalupalik's under there, like, I shouldn't be going near there.
Yeah.
But I know, because we played on and this didn't make any noise or whatever, but two seasons ago in hockey, we played on a freshly done rink. And when we mean freshly done, we're talking like it was done within hours. So we were told it was good to play on. And just to say, like, how fragile ice is,
mm-hmm.
My stick, I took it, and I dropped it from probably waist height. So I was holding the, like, shaft, and I just dropped it down, so the blade hit the ice, and it sent, like, a 4-foot crack in either direction. And we were just like, how are we going to play on this? And it was fine.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it just shows you that, like, that little bit, the ice can change. So I think it makes sense on using something that, like, is this scary
right.
and this as a, like, a lesson thing. Sorry, I just popped my tablet stand out.
Within Inuit folklore, the Kalupalik functions as a symbolic articulation of environmental risk, particularly in liminal zones where land, ice, and water intersect. These transitional spaces, shorelines, tidal cracks, and thin sea ice are consistently identified as areas of heightened danger due to their instability and deceptive appearance. Folklorists and anthropologists commonly interpret the Kalupalik, I'm gonna just bat 1,000 over here, the Kalupalik as a cultural mechanism for encoding environmental knowledge, rather than describing physical processes such as shifting ice, hidden currents, or sudden submersion in technical terms. The legend translates these hazards into a personified presence that can be more easily remembered, transmitted, and acted upon, essentially by children. From this perspective, the Kalupalik does not symbolize moral failure, but environmental miscalculation. Its narrative role marks points where assumed safety collapses and attentiveness to place becomes critical. The figure operates less as a punitive agent and more as an index of risks embedded into the landscape itself. Contemporary research in Nunavut has identified the legend as a historically effective injury prevention strategy in regions with high rates of accidental drowning and ice-related fatalities. While the deterrent impact of such folklore has declined with generational change, its symbolic framework remains relevant, particularly as environmental conditions grow less predictable. Since the 2010s, Inuit scholars and community leaders have increasingly reframed the Kalupalik within discussions of climate change. Thinning ice, altered freeze-thaw cycles, and shifting seasonal patterns have intensified the dangers traditionally associated with sea ice. Repositioning the figure as a symbol of environmental instability rather than solely a folkloric warning. This representation resonates beyond the Arctic. In early 2024, dozens of fishermen were stranded on an ice floe in Lake Erie, prompting a meteorologist to remark that no ice is ever safe ice. Incidents of this kind, once rare, now occur with increasing frequency, reflecting broader climate trends rather than isolated accidents. According to the World Wildlife Federation, the Arctic is warming at roughly twice the global average, with projections suggesting it could become largely ice-free by 2040, which is just insane. Mm-hmm. Like, that's so crazy.
Yep.
Within this context, the Kalupalik functions as a cultural index of uncertainty, an adaptive narrative structure that mirrors the accelerating consequence of ecological disruption. Its continued relevance underscores the value of indigenous knowledge systems in interpreting environments where long-standing assumptions about stability no longer hold.
While the Kalupalik originates in oral tradition, it has increasingly appeared across modern literature, art, and media, each version reshaping how the story is told and who it is for. In children's youth literature, A Promise is a Promise by Michael Cusick and Robert Munsch reframes the Kalupalik as a challenge overcome through intelligence and keeping promises. The Orphan and the Kalupalik by Neil Christopher and The Kalupalik by Alicia Kilbach and Joy Ange focuses on resilience, loss, and the community protection. There's graphic novels, the Putukwa and Club, and the Kalupalik by Rosalind Akalukuk. I'm not even sure. I am so sorry about that.
I would butcher that one.
I have a hard last name, and that puts my name in the simple category.
It does.
And Danny Christopher present the creature as a cautionary figure within empowering youth-centered stories rooted in the Inuit knowledge. Animated adaptions like Kalupalik by the Nunavut Animations Lab bring the legend to screen while maintaining its warning function. The indie game Beneath the Folds uses sounds and narrative choice to recreate the fear of thin ice and unseen movement below. Early written documentation begins with Franz Boas, 1888, the Central Eskimo, which preserved Inuit oral accounts from the Baffin Island. Since the 1970s, storytelling has shifted from outsider documentation toward Inuit-authored and collaborative works, emphasizing self-representation, environmental awareness, and cultural continuity. Today, the Kalupalik exists across media not as a relic of the past, but as a living story, adapting to new audiences while continuing to warn people where not to stand. So in a world mapped by satellites and GPSs, it is easy to believe that there are no mysteries left, that every danger can be measured, that every risk can be predicted. But the Arctic reminds us otherwise. For the Inuit stories, like the Kalupalik, were never about fear for fear's sake. They were about survival, about knowing where not to stand, about remembering that the most dangerous places are often the quietest ones. The edges that look solid until they aren't. Whether understood as a literal being, a spirit tied to a place, or a story shaped by generations of lived experience, its message remains the same. Listen to the warnings, respect the land, pay attention to what has kept people alive for thousands of years. As the Arctic continues to change through ice thinning and shifting seasons, these stories carry renewed weight, not as relics of the past, but as reminders that some knowledge is learned not through data, but through memory. Thank you for listening to the Ominous Archives. You can follow our show on social media under the same name. And this episode was researched and written by Samantha from Scare Me Sam. She always does great work for us. True. And has been such a clutch team member.
So true.
I just think that's... It is such a good... I think it's such an interesting way to... I know we, like, just closed our episode out and all that other stuff, but my, like, final thought is kind of... Their storytelling to like, teach lessons to keep people safe is so, like, cool, where some people, like... I don't want to say, like, for us it was, like, trial by fire, but, you know, you hear these stories and you're just like, oh, wow, and then, like... From a young age, you start putting everything together. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really, really interesting.
Yeah, I agree.
But anyway, we're going to get out of here. So, as always, stay weird and stay haunted. See ya.
See ya.